Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Totally EM. Today with me is Catherine Thompson from IBP Educators, and I met her first at AAPA, at least officially. I kind of seen some stuff of hers before, and I think she saw a little bit of mine too, but we were able to meet in like a little social hangout sort of thing, and with her background experience, I thought, who better to talk to about some of the most challenging subjects and topics I think come up in medicine, particularly in emergency medicine and primary care type settings, just because we're the ones who tend to see this the most, or at least are exposed to it the most. But I think many of us either don't know how best to approach this, don't know the data behind it, or just really uncertain and lack of comfort overall. So I invited Catherine to come on to talk about this a little bit more. And because of the breadth and depth of these topics, it can be very challenging to try and summarize it, especially with someone as knowledgeable as she is. So we're going to kind of break these up a little bit. I'm hoping we can almost do like a little series off of this, where we can talk about kind of one part of acknowledging the background, you know, kind of some of the things you can do to help recognize, and then the second portion about how to treat, how to take care of this, and what we can do as an overall healthcare community. So, Catherine, thank you so much for coming on. And do you mind telling us just a little bit more about what exactly it is that you do?
Sure. And thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. So I'm a PA, and I come to the PA profession from a history in emergency medicine and fire service. But in addition, my unique experience, which has kind of led me down this alternative pathway, has been through the world of sexual assault. So I was previously a sexual assault advocate prior to PA school, and once I became a PA, through a series of extraordinary coincidences, I ended up as a forensic examiner. So I currently work to process forensic exams and forensic kits for an organization here in Los Angeles. And then as I moved into the PA world, as I moved into emergency medicine and started talking to people, I realized that there is a distinct lack of information, knowledge, and empowerment regarding topics such as human trafficking, sexual assault, child abuse, and all of these kind of like really difficult to talk about topics. So that brought me to where we are today, which is IPV Educators. It is a PA-run LLC, and I specialize in helping providers and future providers develop empowerment, education, and knowledge around these topic areas. So that brings us to today.
And you also teach some at PA programs, so a lot of these same concepts, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually one of my primary sources of clients right now is PA programs. I am a little bit of a one-woman marching band for these topic areas, and I would love to eventually see a program such as mine in every PA program. I think it's incredibly relevant, and it is currently not really something that the ARC PA requires. It's left up to the individual program. So I do a lot of work with PA programs to help them establish and maintain topic areas such as these in their curriculum.
Well, that's awesome, Catherine. Thank you so much for doing your part in all of this. And the first topic, because we had a hard time figuring out which topic we really wanted to cover first. And I think the one that has kind of had a lot of buzz recently is human trafficking specifically. And so we wanted to talk about human trafficking for the healthcare environments and what we can do and how we can better identify this patient population so we can better take care of them.
Yes, absolutely. I do think that human trafficking has been kind of a hot button topic recently or in the last several years. And it's incredibly relevant. And like you said earlier, those of us who work, especially in primary care and emergency medicine, we are nearly 100% more likely to encounter victims of human trafficking in our care environments. Healthcare is one of the only resources that intersects human trafficking as much as it does. And so it's really important for healthcare providers to be able to be alert and recognize the signs that point towards human trafficking.
So I bet a lot of us who are listening right now probably think, well, I've never seen this. So maybe we should know a little bit more about the statistics and find out that maybe we actually are seeing this a lot more often than we think.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think you are seeing it more often than anybody really thinks they are. And I can certainly, I mean, I could talk statistics for days, but I will keep it to the most relevant. I would say that it is a huge industry in the United States, well, in the world, but in particular in the United States. It's about a $32 billion industry in the United States. Basically, the most important thing to realize is that 50% of these victims are under 18. 300,000 kids, so under the age of 18, are trafficked every year. Almost 80% of them are female. So they are intersecting the healthcare field through especially like primary care, through like well woman visits, through OBGYN care, other things like that. And we're absolutely definitely seeing them. 88% of trafficking victims report contact with medical providers during their period of being trafficked. So at some point during the time of their trafficking experience, 88%, so nearly all of them, report contact with a medical provider.
That's incredible just how often we're seeing this without really seeing it. Now, some people are going to say, well, does that mean that everyone is, I guess, the most extreme cases, the most extreme incidences of human trafficking? But sometimes human trafficking can be kind of subtle. The definition is still important and doesn't mean that it's any less atrocious what's going on. But since we're talking about this and we have such big numbers that you're mentioning, can you help define a little bit better about what exactly is meant by human trafficking?
So it's important to realize human trafficking, the broadest definition is that in which a person is unwillingly sort of enslaved in some way or another. And what jumps to mind most often, I think, if you ask just about anybody in an informal survey about what they would define human trafficking as, they define it as sex trafficking, which is a big hot button topic these days. But it is important to realize that human trafficking also runs the gamut of all kinds of sort of unwilling or unfair work environments. So not only does it encompass sex trafficking, which is what we most often think of, but also forced labor and labor for immigration purposes and other sort of enslavement of human beings or unwilling movement of human beings from one location to another. Those are all encompassed within human trafficking.
Thank you for that clarification. And that's what I was really going for there, is because a lot of us see sex trafficking. Now, let's, if you don't mind, take sex trafficking on for just a second, because I think that one is such a particular topic that most people are thinking about. Now, this doesn't always have to be the like stuff you see from the movie Taken, for example, although it's not a great example, I understand, of human trafficking, please forgive, but it's probably something that most of us have seen, where we're talking about like organized crime and stuff like that. This can be down to the individual level as well, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a really excellent point. I think overall, in all of these topic areas, the media just loves to latch on to, and by media, I also mean, you know, the entertainment industry just loves to latch on to the most extreme and most sensational and noteworthy cases. And Taken is an excellent example of that. That would be a very extreme example of sex trafficking. But it is very important to realize that this can be on any level. It can be a large, very mobile, very wealthy international ring, down to simply a pimp and a person who is being trafficked. And it could just be two people involved, or it could be a smaller ring. The most common form is what they call like pimp street prostitution. So that is the sort of classic example of a prostitute who is reporting to some sort of pimp. And there's a lot of different kind of like subtypes of pimps out there, but that's like kind of the most common form, followed closely by commercial brothels, followed by escort services.
I never thought I'd say this on this podcast, but I think we're going to have a whole episode on pimping now, because I don't, not the medical pimping either, but just because I didn't realize there were a wide variety of pimps out there. So with that being said, so let's talk about some of the hot spots, I guess, in the United States. So because we've talked about at this point a little bit of the basic statistics, like you said, we can dive into so much more. We've talked about some of the types of human trafficking, with particular mention of sexual trafficking, just because of how much of a hot button issue this is, but understanding that there are other types, like specifically of children and labor and so on. But now I think it's important to talk about too, what are some of the quote-unquote hotspots, understanding that this can show up anywhere in the country?
Basically, there's two ways to kind of break down the hotspots for sex trafficking or for human trafficking in general. If we're talking about sex trafficking, the two main division points or the two ways to sort of break it down are by like urban center or by path of travel. So if you have, so basically like if you're talking about urban centers, it's more common in urban centers. Any larger metropolis, then that's going to be hot center for sex trafficking because it's more common in those areas. The other way to sort of talk about it is by path of travel. So this would be those trafficking victims who are either coming in internationally, like from other countries, or leaving the country for international destinations, or in other ways being moved around the country. In which case, the four biggest states for sex trafficking in the United States are California, Nevada, Texas, and New York. And as you can kind of imagine, if you think about those states in relation to the rest of the nation, those are all kind of like major ports and or like sort of near major border crossing areas. So that's kind of the other way to sort of think about how or where most of the sex trafficking in the country is concentrated.
That's very helpful. I've also noticed too that at least from what I've seen of data, I don't know what you have for support of this or if there's something kind of key with it, talking about the means of travel and how populations move and stuff, that most of us and many hospitals are near or right along, in some cases, major highways. And so major highways are a big avenue because obviously big highways, easy to move and move quickly through. So a lot of interstate traffic occurs and a lot of human trafficking, just like trafficking of other items, occurs along these major highways. And so if you're near a major highway, just keep in mind that this could be one source of human trafficking.
Precisely. Yes. It is similar to, you know, taken being kind of an extreme example, the most common form of transport of trafficking victims is by car. So if you're looking at like major highways, major, you know, routes through multiple states, it's going to be mostly car transport. So as a, just kind of a random aside statistic, here in California, actually one of the biggest cities for human trafficking is a small town called Pomona, California, which is kind of outside of Los Angeles, a suburb community of Los Angeles. And you would never think that it would be a major port for human trafficking, but it is because it is bordered on two sides by major east-west highways.
But I actually learned while we were in PA school that, because we talked a little bit about human trafficking, I mean, it's a very short few lessons about it, but mm-hmm. that because of all the major highways, as well as having the lakes so close, the Great Lakes, that Toledo was actually a pretty bad place for human trafficking for many of the same reasons that you mentioned, which is where I went to PA school at, was up in Toledo, Ohio.
I would absolutely believe it. I think that rule applies pretty much nationwide. The closer and more accessible multiple routes of exit are, I think the more likely you are to have a maybe slightly higher or greatly higher population of trafficking.
So let's move on just a little bit and talk about some of the techniques that are frequently employed by perpetrators to obtain and maintain a lot of these victims.
Yeah.
Such as like drug use and emotional manipulation, threats, etc.
Exactly. So there is a there is a way of thinking about human trafficking that I think is relevant to begin this discussion with. It's called the action means purpose model. So action plus means plus purpose. And basically that defines an overarching kind of concept for like how trafficking ends up occurring. So the action is the action that is undertaken by the traffickers to exploit people. So that would be things like recruiting, harboring, transporting, providing, or obtaining an individual. The means is how that is done. And there are things like threats, coercion, abduction, fraud, force, abuse of power. And we're going to talk about all of those. And then the purpose being the exploitation of people. So forced labor, servitude, sexual exploitation, all those things that we kind of just talked about. So that basically kind of gets us started. And then there's really multiple different ways that means are employed. And it largely depends on both the individual circumstance and the area, and also what the person is being trafficked for. One of the most common techniques that is employed is the use of like threats or coercion in some way. So as a subcategory to that, the two probably most common are threats of harm and threats of ruining the person in some other way. So one of the most common there would be exploiting immigration status as a technique to maintain control over an individual. The other technique that's like most commonly used is drug addiction. So frequently drugs form kind of a hinging point for a trafficking relationship, meaning that either the person is supplied drugs in exchange for their services, and thus they remain sort of dependent upon that relationship in order to maintain their habit, or it's more of a threat, meaning that if the person does not provide the services, they will no longer be able to obtain the drugs that they are addicted to or feel like they need. And then there's other techniques, other kind of like psychological techniques. One of the most interesting and one that I feel like I run into a fair amount, especially in like larger urban centers, is something called the like Romeo pimp. The person who is being trafficked is made to believe that they are in a loving and equal relationship with their pimp. They call him their boyfriend or their girlfriend or whatever. And they believe that this is how they show their love or their service to this individual. And then that's how it's portrayed by the pimp, is that, you know, if you really loved me, you would do this for me. And so they do. And those can be very complicated cases to sort of unwrap, because they are very protective of what they feel to be a loving relationship with their pimp.
The last one is really kind of intriguing to me, because I think it's the one that a lot of times can be hard, especially on the emergency medicine side, where we only have a few minutes with these patients, to actually discern and tease out and realize what's going on, because that person may simply be introduced as their boyfriend and they're sitting in the corner and they don't say much, or sometimes they say a lot. The ones that are easier, I think, sometimes to pick are the ones who step in and answer all the questions for the patient. But right, sometimes they just kind of stand there back off to the side, could be very quiet, let the whole encounter occur, and we are none the wiser. And I think that individual kind of level of human trafficking is probably one of the harder ones to see, versus one of the other types that you talked about that I find so interesting with human trafficking in general is the immigration side of this. Not to get into some big political debate, but I mean, we know this happens where people are being trafficked along the border, and sometimes to get into the country, to try and get out of their current situations, they come to the United States in hope of something better. But in the process, they can't afford it, or they use obviously means that are not entirely legal to get into the United States in hope of doing something better. And in the process, they get caught up in something much larger and become basically trafficked, and unfortunately have a hard time of getting out of it, because they're supposed to buy their way out in some cases. At least this is kind of what I've seen and learned about before, is they'll try and buy their way out, but they never have the money to actually buy themselves out. So they're constantly stuck in this forced slavery.
Exactly. And on that topic, you know, there's kind of two major salient points there that I think are worth highlighting. One is that, like, even outside of an immigration situation, often one of the techniques that's employed by traffickers is controlling identification. So whether it is green card or legal immigration papers or a marriage license, because they've been forced into marriage or coerced into marriage in some way, and that is providing them the legal means to live in this country and move around this country. So even if they are a legal citizen, if their pimp is controlling their driver's license, their social security card, any information that they could possibly need in order to become independent, then that really forms, you know, a very easy way to control somebody in this country. And then the second lucrative point there is that if it is sort of an immigration situation, a lot of times there are additional barriers that prevent the person from kind of seeking or wanting to seek independence, one of which is language barriers. So if the person is in a country, maybe they don't even know which country they're in, depending on how far they've been trafficked, and they don't speak the language, they cannot move around the country effectively. And that really forms a very easy way to control somebody.
So Catherine, that's a great point as far as something to consider is the whole language barrier side of this, because I think it's just that much harder to detect what is going on. So kind of leading into that a little bit more, can we talk about some of the common presentations, some of the common ways we may see these patients come to us?
Sure. I always joke with my students when I'm teaching, like at a PA program or another environment, I tell them, here's this lady coming to talk to us again and tell us that there are no good ways to identify any of these people. And yet there's a serious problem here and we need to be able to identify it. So it is true. There are some red flags and there are some sort of classic presentations. But I always kind of start this part of my discussion by saying that, you know, unfortunately, they aren't wearing a sign. They aren't wearing a sign that says, hey, I'm being trafficked, help me. So it can be difficult to identify them. And that's where this sort of empowerment and the awareness comes in. Because the more you think about this, it's kind of the paradox, the more you think about it, the more likely you are to be cognizant to the possibility, and thus the more likely you are to be able to pick up on more and more subtle presentations the longer you kind of practice this art. That all being said, I think that when we're talking about sex trafficking in particular, one of the most common sort of like red flags or things to sort of look out for are frequent sexually transmitted infections, pelvic inflammatory disease, or like UTIs. So this is where our primary care friends can be very helpful, because if we see somebody in the ER for a single incident of a UTI, we may not know whether they're also visiting like multiple other hospitals, or if they are, you know, if they come back, we might not be the provider that sees them. So if we have somebody who is coming in for really frequent, like sexually transmitted infections, or for really frequent STI checks or UTIs or things like that, then it should raise our awareness level. This doesn't necessarily mean that we're shutting the place down, we're calling the police, you know, we're like isolating the boyfriend, that kind of thing, but rather just to sort of pique our interest, to ask us to sort of look a little bit deeper. Another kind of point that forms a red flag, or that forms something that maybe should elevate our interest a little bit, is poor dental hygiene or malnutrition and or poor like physical hygiene. So all of those areas, yes, could point to other, you know, reasons we might be interested, like for example, like neglect or drug abuse or homelessness or other things like that. But in particular, poor dental hygiene tends to be associated with human trafficking, because it's less likely that they are receiving the sort of wellness like checks as far as like dental care is concerned that they may need in order to be like healthy from a dental perspective. And then lastly, of course, substance abuse issues is another big red flag. So if you have somebody that has substance abuse issues, whether it's alcohol or drugs or both, then that should definitely sort of raise your awareness that there may be other issues, comorbid or concurrent issues that are happening, one of which that could be trafficking on some level.
Great. So that covers a lot of the key points and at least some of the highlights. Obviously, I'm sure you could dive into so much more given the various presentations that can be seen. But one last thing I kind of want to ask about as far as this side, because again, we're going to have to split this up into two parts just because there's so much great information, is what about the actual presence of the trafficker and the interview and the patient care side, at least on the detection level?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always think that it's like overall, it's a really good idea for care providers to be aware and cognizant to how people are interacting with the other people in the room, the supposed loved ones that they've brought with them. And I think that's just kind of a good overall principle. But some of the things that we kind of like look for when we're talking about human trafficking is we talk about how willing the person, the loved one or the boyfriend or whatever they're being called, how willing that person is to leave, to give the patient privacy. So if basically like it's the concept of being, or is the patient like kind of closely guarded? So in other words, like if you throw a line out there and, you know, do like dip your toe in the water and say, hey, you know, boyfriend, would you mind just stepping out of the room? I just want to talk to your girlfriend privately for a few minutes. And the answer is no, or very suspicious, or, you know, no, I'm not leaving the patient alone, or any of those kind of like those kind of things. And that may raise your awareness for the possibility of human trafficking, because I think that, you know, every individual, every free individual in the world has a right to personal privacy. And we hope that the people that they are in loving relationships with would respect that. We also look for, and this again, primary care friends may be more able to access kind of this information or have maybe slightly longer timeframes in which to talk to patients about this. But we look for access to money. So do they have access to money? Do they appear afraid about like their financial situation? When you ask them like what kind of job they have, you know, how their finances are distributed, what kind of responses do you get? Do you get that, you know, their employer keeps a lot of their money, or that they're currently paying off a debt to their employer, or that their boyfriend manages the money or husband or whatever the case may be? And that can kind of be something that we look for. And then we also look for how they interact with the person in the room. So do they look to the person for all the answers to the questions? Do they appear kind of afraid or distrustful? Do they seem to be measuring their words or speaking only kind of like a scripted answer to things? And then lastly, one of the things that we look for, especially in like immigration trafficking, is we look for what kind of English vocabulary they have. Do they have any? If they do, what kind of words are they using in English? So are they using only a sexualized vocabulary, or are they only responding to sexualized words? Or do they have what would appear to be a rudimentary, broad English vocabulary, which is really the way that you would learn English if you were learning it outside of a trafficked environment?
So Catherine, that is a ton of great information. And I feel like, you know, for many of us, our brains are probably overwhelmed with all these facts and information. So what I'd like to do is break this up into a second part where we can talk more about what we can do after we have the suspicion of this going on. But before we leave for today, can you go ahead and give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.